mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, Making More Possible. The Community Foundation has reached a historic milestone, surpassing $100 million in total grants awarded to Findlay and Hancock County through its stewardship of more than $200 million in total assets. Also this morning, it is our nation's birth certificate and so much more. As America approaches its 250th birthday, the Declaration of Independence is a powerful statement about who we are and who we strive to be. And happening around town, everyone's invited to a community picnic this week as Flag City USA celebrates America 250. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026. So we're coming up on America's 250th birthday. You know that. It's less than 2 weeks away. Are you getting excited now? Well, a new ranking from WalletHub lists the most patriotic states in America. And number one on the list, Virginia. The Commonwealth of Virginia, the most patriotic state in the nation, based on WalletHub's list. The findings are based on 13 indicators, which seems appropriate, 13 indicators for the 13 original colonies, 13 indicators of patriotism, including military enlistment, the number of veterans who live, reside in each particular state, voter participation, very, very important, and a number of AmeriCorps volunteers per capita, which I thought is an interesting metric to use there. But Virginia, number one, Montana is second on that list, and Vermont ranks third, followed by Colorado and Oregon, rounding out the top five. By the way, if you're curious, because I was, Arkansas is considered the least patriotic state. Arkansas. And before you start deriding Arkansas for their lack of patriotism, apparently, according to this list, keep in mind that Ohio could certainly do better. We're not at the bottom of the list, but we have a long way to go. The Buckeye State ranked number 36 overall. So, I don't know, you may agree or disagree, but that's the way WalletHub ranks us. 36th, most patriotic. Clearly, they have never visited Flag City, USA, is all I can say on that. What's more American than M&M's? Did you hear this? M&M's are going to be releasing their artificial dye-free candies in August. You remember, some weeks ago, after pressure from Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is consistently criticized the use of artificial dyes in U.S. food products, calling them a key driver in numerous American health epidemics. And that declaration is disputed by some, but the general consensus is that fewer artificial dyes are good for us, whether they are an explicit cause of numerous American health epidemics, as the HHS secretary declares, generally having fewer artificial dyes is going to be good for us. So M&M Mars have decided to do away with the artificial dyes in M&Ms. And Mars is one of 27 corporations that have pledged to remove artificial dyes from certain products, in the effort to eliminate petroleum-based food dyes from the U.S. food supply. But here's the thing. They're going to come out in August. Be prepared, because there will no longer be any brown M&Ms or blue M&Ms. Those are the two colors that they cannot replicate cost-effectively with natural dyes. So no more brown or blue M&Ms. That's a shock. I thought it was really interesting that red will still be available. I don't know how far back you remember, but there didn't used to be red M&Ms. For the longest time, there were no red M&Ms because the dye they used for red M&Ms way back when ended up being banned, and they just eliminated the red M&Ms, and then those came back when they found an alternative dye, and now they are going to be available, but the blue and the brown, brown's been around forever, and blue is a little more recent, but brown has been around forever, and now no more brown M&Ms, so I'm just saying, prepare yourself for some changes to your next bag of M&Ms, at least beginning in August. So that's when they will come out. So big news. That's why we're here. Share the big news stories, the important stuff. The first things you need to know this morning, the very first things you need to know. This is interesting sports news. A new research project. I don't know if it's a research project so much, but this was a story in the LA Times that claims climate change could be leading to more home runs in Dodger Stadium. More home runs, Dodger Stadium. Blame it on climate change, apparently. For much of the stadium's history, they say the nighttime marine layer would make it tough for fly balls to carry far enough to leave the park. But in the past few years, that has changed. Why? Well, the Times quotes a NASA scientist who said that the marine layer has generally disappeared in the past several years, which baseball insiders say make Dodger Stadium a much better home run hitters park, because the marine layer has generally disappeared, is what NASA says. The scientists are saying. Or it, I'm thinking it could also be explained by having Shohei Ohtani in the lineup. That's probably no small part of the fact that there are more home runs being hit in Dodger Stadium. They've got Shohei Ohtani. I'm just saying. By the way, speaking of sports, you know, the World Cup is taking place in North America. Most of the games being played in the United States. And for the most part, Americans in the cities that are hosting the games are incredibly happy to have all of these foreign tourists who are in such great spirits and in the true spirit of camaraderie and world citizenship coming in to cheer their country on and bonding through sport. You know, it's the global bonding through sport. It has just been amazing to see all the videos. Nowhere is that more on display than in Boston, where the residents there embraced the Scottish Tartan Army and all of their mischief and revelry. And it's been just wonderful to see. There are other countries being welcomed in other cities. However, not everyone is happy for the World Cup onslaught of foreign sports fans. Waiters in New Jersey and in New York City, which, by the way, the World Cup final will be played at MetLife Stadium, and they're not calling it MetLife Stadium because FIFA has a problem with sponsored stadium names. But anyway, I digress. That's where the final will be played. So they're doing a lot of matches there in New York, New Jersey. But waiters and waitresses there say that fans are not tipping. This is a big deal in the New York, New Jersey area. World Cup related spending is bringing big bucks to many businesses, but not to bars and restaurants, even though fans are having fun, drinking lots of beer, eating with gusto, and watching matches, you know, on TV for the ones that can't go to the games. It's not that the service is poor. Waiters say FIFA fans from around the world are very friendly. They just are not tipping. Many international tourists apparently don't realize that that's the norm in this country. In most of Europe, for instance, waiters are paid just like any other worker on a job, and they don't have to rely on gratuities in order to get by. It's the tipping culture is uniquely American, and the international visitors don't realize that, and they're not leaving tips. Wow. I never really thought about that, but yeah, that could be a big problem. I can see that's the culture clash with respect to tipping in this country versus the rest of the world. And by the way, speaking of a clash of cultures, here's another story where apparently not all is well with the World Cup revelry. Hundreds of rowdy English soccer fans had to be cleared out of a pub in Dallas after reportedly drinking 5,000 beers ahead of Wednesday's World Cup match against Croatia. They collectively drank 5,000 beers. Crowd packed into the Londoner Tavern. The Londoner Tavern, which would seem to be a natural gathering point for English soccer fans. The Londoner Tavern. They must have felt, hey, we'll be right at home here. Well, they packed in from the bar to the patio. The pub had to shut down because there were so many fans. And believe it or not, it says here, police responded to a 911 call about the crowd. There were no reported arrests, but they actually called 911 because of the size of the crowd. They were worried it might get out of control. And I saw that story and I'm thinking, this is what we are seeing is the regional differences in American culture on display. Because in Boston, as we mentioned, the Scots literally drank the town dry and residents practically begged them not to leave. In Dallas, they called the cops. Definitely a different mindset depending on what city you are in. As fans getting a quick lesson in regional differences in attitudes of the locals to rowdy sports fans. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchak. Your WTOL 11 weather. Sunny skies expected today with a high in the 70s. Mostly clear tonight, low in the 50s. A group pushing to ban large data centers in Ohio is falling well short of the number of signatures necessary to get their proposed constitutional amendment on the November ballot.
Conserve Ohio announced they've collected about 70,000 voter signatures so far. They needed more than 400,000 by July 1st. They also say more than 1,000 volunteers have joined the cause and later say they will continue to collect signatures to try to get the proposed amendment on the 2027 general election ballot.
In April, Findlay City Council approved an ordinance imposing a 12-month moratorium on data centers within city limits. Get more on that in this story on our website. Raise the Bar Hancock County says it's honored to have earned three state designations recently. The Ohio Manufacturers Association endorsed partnership, the Ohio Department of Development Industry Sector Partnership Grantee, and the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce Regional Education Partnership. Raise the Bar says all three designations recognize their dedicated work in preparing the workforce, and they look forward to their ongoing collaborations with business, education, social services, and policymakers in advancing workforce excellence. The University of Findlay has received Collegiate Purple Star designation for its commitment in supporting students with military backgrounds. UF President Emeritus Dr. Catherine Fell says the university values the service and sacrifice made by these men and women, and the university partners with the Veterans Administration to provide the highest level of benefits possible for their military-affiliated students. Learn more about the Collegiate Purple Star designation and this story on our website. The Findlay Family YMCA will be hosting a youth triathlon this summer at Riverside Park. The Y says the event is appropriate for all skill levels, both as an introduction to the sport for beginners and as a challenge for the serious competitor. Get more details on the youth triathlon in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
Mm-hmm. Well, in case you hadn't heard the news, with a motto of making more possible, the Community Foundation has reached a historic milestone, surpassing $100 million in total grants awarded to Findlay and Hancock County through its stewardship of more than $200 million in total assets. And CEO Brian Treese is with us this morning with a big smile on his face. Those Definitely. Are pretty impressive numbers.
We are very excited for both of those milestones, recognizing that those milestones come with so many partners through the years. And we're so thankful and grateful to be celebrating this with our community.
I want to start with the $100 million in grants awarded, and I thought it was really good. The Board of Trustees actually in their statement, I think, put it best when they said it's not just the amount of money, which is certainly a significant sum, but it is the impact that those dollars have had within the community. What are some of the ways that really stand out to you when you look at the ways that those dollars have been put to use in the community? Because this is something that many people don't necessarily see. You know, they see right. the results, but they may not understand, you know, where those dollars come from with the things that they kind of take for granted.
Well, $100 million is really hard to wrap your hands around yeah. and to think yeah. about. So what we did, knowing that this milestone was coming up, we went back to the archives and started looking. Our first grants, we were originally part of the Cleveland Foundation.
Right.
And so we looked at the very first grants that we ever made up until the ones that we've recently made. And we wanted to pick out some of those projects that were still really visible, especially from our early years. And one of our first grants was to start an economic development office in Hancock County. Hmm. So when you think about what decades later, the jobs, the growth, the business development that has come from that, that's pretty profound. You also see it with city planning. When you look at both the city of Findlay and multiple villages, the millions and millions that have been invested in making sure that each community is as strong as it can be. We have one of our flagships, the Family Center. About $7 million has been invested in the Family Center through the years. Housing, we're looking at $4.5 million and growing in housing. Marathon Center for the Performing Arts through the years. Our investment started when we renovated then Central Junior High School's auditorium years ago.
Wow.
And then we revisited Central as a potential space for the performing arts. And that turned into multiple grants over a number of years. The Parks District, our first grant to the Park District was to purchase Schenck Lake, which would become part of Oakwoods. And so through the years, we've invested, again, millions into the parks, looking at trails, looking at educational opportunities. We even funded at one point a Smokey Bear costume years ago. Education, millions are invested in school districts every year. And then scholarships, which we recently cleared another milestone with scholarships. Looking at all of that combined, we think it would be really hard to find a significant project since 1979 that the foundation hasn't been part of, or to find someone in Hancock County, anyone in Hancock County, who hasn't been impacted somehow by foundation funding.
That's the thing that really stands out to me, because again, a lot of these things, like we said, are, you know, parts of the community that we almost take for granted and just assume that they're there. The Family Center, economic development, you know, they're just there and they've always been there. But we don't stop to think of what made that possible. And this is the driving force behind all of that. And I think it's also important just to underscore what you were saying. This is not just Findlay. Certainly communities all over Hancock County have been touched by this. Most recently, Heart and Soul Initiative. I know we talked about that You know, when that launched a few years ago, but that has really kind of spread the wealth out into all of the surrounding communities as well.
When we are doing our job best, we are serving the entire county. And Heart and Soul started because we took a hard look at our grant making and realized that most of the transformative grants were happening within the city limits. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't okay.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of research and a lot of discussions, which eventually resulted in our partnership with Community Heart and Soul, which when you look at Macomb, Mount Blanchard, Arlington, Arcadia, there's big things happening in those communities, and Heart and Soul played a part in that.
Yeah. And of course, as you said, none of this would be possible without all of the donors and a lot of individual people. As we mentioned, the second milestone is that $200 million in total assets that you steward. And talk a little bit about how that happens, because again, you can't do all of these wonderful things without the funding that makes it possible.
Yeah, when we think about making more possible, the real power of endowment is that that $200 million, all of those dollars that are endowed will last in perpetuity or will last forever because we grant a portion of those out every year. And mm-hmm. when the market cooperates, as we often hope it does, then that those dollars last forever. So when somebody makes an endowed gift, it will help whatever the cause is, whether it be for the common good, whether it be for a specific agency, mm-hmm. it will continue granting forever.
Yeah. And for those, those, to put it very simply, for those who don't maybe understand the concept, think of it as having a huge retirement account and just living off the interest. The principal stays there forever, and you can live off the interest for as long as you like. So it's the same kind of thing.
Right. And I talk about how we're just getting started because truly we are. Because of, all of our current donors who are incredibly generous, and also those that came before who cemented their legacies in Hancock County by having the common belief that more is going to happen after their lifetime.
Yeah.
And how can I be part of that?
Now, I know with some of those endowments, there are specific guidelines as to how individuals want those dollars to be used, to be put to use. But then there are others that are much more flexible. How do you decide? Take us a little kind of through the process of deciding where that funding goes, even within the confines of those directed funds.
So we have over 600 funds, and each of those 600 funds has a different set of rules that the donor outlined in their gift. So I see you smiling because imagine one of our responsibilities is making sure we take donor intent very seriously.
Yeah.
So every time we do that fund agreement, we work with the donor on what kind of impact do you hope to have and how do we set up mechanisms that will stand the test of time? Because we will continue going long after any of us are here. Mm-hmm. So how do we set up backup plans after backup plans? So most of our funds have at least three layers of backup plans to make sure that, I hope that at some point all of the funds benefiting cancer patient services are no longer needed.
Yeah.
In my heart, I hope that. So we have backup plans for when hopefully down the road that happens. But the donor tells us the most restrictive tend to be like scholarship funds.
Right.
Where there's a whole process or designated where we say the donor says we want this fund to benefit Christian Clearing House or the YMCA or mm-hmm. or whatever specific organization. The other ones, they say, I don't know what the future holds.
Yeah.
So I know that I care about education. So as long as it supports education, that's what I hope. And then we have some that say, I don't have a crystal ball. I think I will trust forever that the board of the Community Foundation will be able to put it to use on the most pressing issues in our community.
Yeah.
And those are those most flexible.
Yeah. The other point to make is again, along the lines of when we talk about none of this would be possible without the people who are making the donations and adding to that endowment. It's not a 200 people who have donated $1 million. It's not even 1 million people who have donated $200. So many are individuals. You don't have to have $1 million. You don't have to have, you know, this huge amount of money to create, to start or to contribute or create one of these funds.
That's one of the powers of endowment, is that it's a multiplier. So like you said, you don't have to give a huge gift, or any size of gift, any bit of generosity is pooled with all this other collective generosity in our community to make an amplified impact. And that's one of the really fun parts of what we do, is like you said, it's not just a couple donors. We're talking thousands and thousands of donors through the years that have made that decision to trust that there will be bigger impact when they work together and work collectively. And things like that give me, I'm an optimist 100%, but days when we have this avalanche of collective generosity just reinforce that the future is bright in our community, because I believe that we can do everything together.
And we will leave it there. This is exactly how we get to $1 million in total grants awarded and $200 million in total assets for the Community Foundation. And real quickly, in the last 30 seconds here, you're now branching out, as we've talked about before, just like this Community Foundation got started through a partnership with the in Cleveland. You're now branching out to start similar programs elsewhere.
Yeah, we are having conversations. We started an affiliate program within the last year, which allows us the opportunity to give back everything that Cleveland gave to us when we started.
Yeah. So talk about paying it forward, not just to the community, but the Community Foundation itself paying it forward as well. And again, CEO Brian Treese with us this morning. A couple of significant milestones for the Community Foundation of Findlay and Hancock County. Brian, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, as everyone knows, next weekend we will mark America's 250th birthday, our semi-quincentennial. And the document that makes that possible is more than just our nation's birth certificate, if you will. As we approach Independence Day, the Declaration of Independence, we are reminded, is a powerful statement about who we are and who we strive to be. Joining us this morning is Dr. Scott Gerber. He is a friend of the program, having him many times on the show in the past. He is the Declaration of Independence Scholar at the University of Mississippi's Declaration of Independence Center. And Scott, are we guilty sometimes of forgetting the significance of the Declaration of Independence? I mean, you know, we know that's the document that, you know, declared our independence from Great Britain, but, you know, I think that for many people, that's as far as it goes.
Yeah, I think we fail to appreciate that, as you pointed out a second ago, it's not just announcing that we're our own country. Mm-hmm. It articulates our political and moral purposes as a country.
And I think it's really interesting. You make the point that while the Constitution is the ends, we talk about the means to an end. The Constitution is the end, the guiding document as to how we put that into practice. The Declaration is the means. That's what really guides everything that is in the Constitution.
That's correct. My first book is called To Secure These Rights. I wrote it in the prior century, but I made that point there, and I documented in that book that that's what the framers understood. I pointed out the evidence from the Philadelphia Convention and the Federalist Papers and all of that, where the framers said that the Constitution is just the structure
yeah,
designed to implement That's... our founding principles. And then in my op-ed that you link to on your webpage, Abraham Lincoln, of course, made that point famously. He mm-hmm. understood it.
Yeah. You wrote an op-ed piece for Fox News that I thought was really interesting in demonstrating this. You cite Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who I know is a hero of yours and, by the way, has a birthday today. So happy birthday to Justice Thomas. So maybe it's appropriate we're talking about it today. That was not designed that way, but happy coincidence that he frequently uses and espouses that very principle of using the Declaration to interpret the Constitution.
Exactly. And what I'm about to say will show how old I am. When my first book was my revised PhD dissertation from the University of Virginia. And when I was writing that book, Justice Thomas, then Judge Thomas, was nominated to the Supreme Court. And I read in the media that he was also interested in the relationship between the Declaration and the Constitution. And because of that, I just simply started following his career. And the origins of his interest in that were when he was chair of the EEOC, he wanted to return the EEOC to its proper purposes. And in his view, it was to protect individual rights, not group rights. Mm-hmm. And so he read a lot about Lincoln and the Declaration. And then ever since that point, he used to give a lot of speeches, but he literally cites the Declaration of Independence in his Supreme Court cases on civil rights. And in my op-ed, I mentioned two of them, but he does it more than that. And so he understands it. Most of the other justices don't. Some in the past, long, long ago, like Stephen Field at the end of the 19th century, he understood it, but now they don't. He does. The rest of them don't.
And was that when you were talking about coming to that realization, as you're reading that piece and associating the Declaration to the Constitution, was that kind of a light bulb moment for you, to say, hey, wait a minute, this is true. I mean, because I can see people when you start thinking about it in those terms, maybe a lot of folks never even thought about it that way.
Well, in terms of my own personal light bulb, as you put it, I was taking a seminar in graduate school at the University of Virginia, and we were reading all these famous books about how to interpret the Constitution by Robert Bork, Ronald Dworkin, and people like that. Mm-hmm. And their arguments were, of course, interesting, and they're bright people. But it always turned on, in my view, what they wanted the Constitution to mean. And I thought there has to be a more objective way to do it than that. I agreed with people like that the Constitution, you can't interpret the Constitution, especially vague provisions like equal protection or free speech, without recourse to values. So my mission was, okay, what values have we agreed to as a country?
Yeah.
And so I decided that it was those in the Declaration because, as you know, Jefferson famously wrote, all men are created equal, mm-hmm. that they're endowed by the Creator with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that kind of thing.
And I wonder, the reason that this is so fascinating to me is because we spend so much time debating and discussing and arguing over what is in the Constitution and what it means, but so very rarely we look back. And it goes back to what we were mentioning earlier, that people kind of almost forget about the Declaration of Independence and the fact that it's more than just saying, hey, we're a free country, and kind of let the chips fall where they may. We really should know more about the Declaration so that we can properly interpret the way our founding fathers constructed the Constitution that followed.
Correct. And as I point out in the op-ed, Justice Thomas's critics often say that he's just anchored in the past and we have to interpret things for today. But what they forget is that the Declaration articulates our principles, and our understanding and our courage to enforce those principles can change. And Lincoln was the best example of understanding that. You know, Lincoln said that, obviously slavery was inconsistent with the equality promise in the Declaration. Reverend King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech making that point. And Lincoln understood that inconsistency. But Lincoln said, okay, the country had to get formed first and then strong enough to rid an institution, i.e. slavery, that we all knew was inconsistent with our founding principle. And Lincoln said, now is the time that we're going to do it, and he's going to get it done. So he understood it.
That is such a perfect example that, you know, when we eliminated slavery, we didn't do it because it was unconstitutional per se. In fact, there were many provisions within the Constitution that addressed and accommodated slavery at the time. It was the foundation of the Declaration of Independence that served as the impetus for eliminating that scourge from the country. So it's a perfect example.
Correct. Right. And the 14th Amendment with the Equal Protection Clause in it, you know, a lot of scholars have done a lot of historical research on that, and they've concluded that it was designed to reinforce the promise of equality in the Declaration of Independence. And yeah, equality, according to the founders, was that we're all supposed to enjoy natural freedom. And of course, slavery is inconsistent with that. And so it's the chance to of equal opportunity, not equal results. So if someone works harder than me or is smarter than me, they're supposed to get, you know, get paid more or whatever than me, et cetera. And so that's what equality means, that we're all supposed to be free people, that if you work hard and you have certain gifts, that you're supposed to enjoy the fruits of those labors.
So I guess the bottom line and the point that we're making here is that if we really want to truly understand, appreciate, and properly interpret the master laws of the land, the Constitution, we really need to understand that founding document that serves as its basis, as you mentioned. It's the guide for the principles that we set out, and it's about time that we actually start studying the Declaration of Independence a little more in more detail than maybe what we have in the past.
Absolutely. And on Constitution Day, Chief Justice Roberts says that he rereads the Constitution. I think that people on July 4th, you know, have your hot dogs, watch your fireworks, but also reread the Declaration. It's not that long, but it's also beautifully written. That's yeah, why Jefferson was assigned the task, because he wrote beautifully. And G.K. Chesterton famously remarked about how beautifully the Declaration was written. So you can get it on the internet for free.
Absolutely.
So just take a look at it, read it, and think about it, because yeah, it's all there. It's all in the second paragraph, the famous second paragraph. And Walter Isaacson, that famous journalist, he wrote a very short book, 30 pages, called The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. And he's talking about the sentence that we hold these truths to be self-evident, you know, all of that. All men are created equal.
Absolutely.
Endowed by a creator with unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, all of that. And so people should read it and understand the genius of it and what the country is supposed to be about. It's right there. That's what we're supposed to be about.
That is absolutely the message, and worth a read if you've never actually read the whole thing top to bottom. Again, Dr. Scott Gerber with us this morning, Declaration of Independence scholar at the University of Mississippi's Declaration of Independence Center. We'll have a link on our webpage for more information. And Dr. Gerber, thanks very much for taking the time. As always, we appreciate it.
You're welcome, Chris. I'm always happy to join you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
I'm loving the new broken news introduction. These are their stories. In St. Augustine, Florida, 47-year-old Michelle Bannister faces felony charges after allegedly attacking another player with a pickleball paddle. Police say Ms. Bannister struck 50-year-old Ron Bonat multiple times in the head with her paddle, causing facial cuts and significant bleeding. The incident apparently began as an argument between Mr. Bonat and Ms. Bannister's son about the playing style, about his playing style after the match ended. Apparently, Mr. Bonat was not too complimentary Ms. Bannister's son's playing style, and that sparked the attack. Officers reported that Ms. Bannister injected herself into the dispute and attacked Mr. Bonat, even though witnesses indicated that no imminent threat existed. So it was not a justifiable paddleball or pickleball paddle attack. Ms. Bannister, who is, by the way, a licensed nurse practitioner and former Marine, was charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon. The deadly weapon being the pickleball paddle. It's a dangerous sport. It's a dangerous sport. Look out, rugby. Pickleball's coming for you. It's the most dangerous sport in the world. Elsewhere in the broken news, in Los Angeles, Mayor Karen Bass is promising a thorough and transparent investigation after the LAPD shot and killed a pet dog in Canoga Park last Saturday night. Not this previous Saturday, but last, a week ago, Saturday. The shooting took place after officers responded to reports of screams coming from a woman's apartment. The LAPD says officers opened fire after a 2-year-old St. Bernard Doodle Mix charged at them. Officers later found out that the woman was screaming not because the dog was attacking her, but in her excitement for the New York Knicks winning the NBA championship. Oh, man. Wow. You talk about a big oops on that one. Somebody's got some splaining to do. And speaking of animals, here's an animal story with a much happier ending. In Seneca Falls, New York, a kitten is safe and sound after repeatedly testing the theory about what curiosity does to cats. The local police department was called to rescue a kitten who had gotten himself caught in a vehicle engine compartment. After being successfully rescued, the little guy apparently decided he wasn't quite ready to be caught and ran straight into the engine compartment of a second vehicle nearby. After a little more teamwork and patience, the kitten was safely rescued and is now doing well. So that one, at least, has a happy ending. There you go. That is your broken news update for this Tuesday morning. The odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Riverside Civic Concert Series means great music each Wednesday night. Along with the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts, WFIN is proud to emcee another season of concerts at the Band Shell at Riverside Park. This week, the Findlay Civic Concert Band. Concerts are at 7 p.m., then Sunday morning at 11. We air that week's concert courtesy of Coldwell Banker Flag City. Join us on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. The price of everything has gone up in recent years astronomically, and that includes the cost of caring for your pet. Veterinary costs have surged nearly 60% in the past decade. Routine care now averages $4,272 a year. And this has forcing many pet owners to weigh their love for their pets against what they can realistically afford. A new study from Healthy Paws Pet Insurance finds 77% of pet owners view their pets like family, like a child, and yet 76% admit that there is a price where they would have to decline treatment. And about one third set that limit at or below $1,000. It's just the reality of it. Now, that being said, 62% of those in the survey said that they would take on new debt in order to save the life of a pet. And 24% have carried credit card balances for caring for their pet. So as we've mentioned, tomorrow evening, Riverside Park, the Findlay Civic Concert Band will perform their 75th anniversary show. Big show from the Findlay Civic Concert Band, and the Civic Concert Series continues. But there is more than just that going on at the park, and we encourage you to stop by early to take part in a huge community picnic as part of Flag City USA's celebration of America 250. It is being put on by the City of Findlay, and Jacqueline Homan is with us this morning to give us all of the details.
Yeah, absolutely. So the official picnic is scheduled from 5 to 7 p.m.
Okay.
That will include inflatables that are free. I know we've gotten some of those questions. Also, we have about 8 food trucks, local food trucks that'll be there. So we're excited about that. Also, some souvenir stations where you can, you know, decorate your own America 250 kites and bandanas and all of the like. It's just a little bit of something for everyone. And then also from 11 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, our boathouse will have free rentals. So that's kayaking, canoeing, and paddle boating in 30-minute sessions. So anybody's welcome to come take advantage of that as well.
So what food trucks are going to be there? I don't mean to put you on the spot, you know, what can folks enjoy food wise?
Yes, absolutely. So we have the Rolling Food Joint. We have Cousins Maine Lobster. We have the Greek Garden, B&A Egg Rolls. And that's just to name a few. I know Tom's Travel and Coffee. Mm-hmm. So we'll have something for everyone. We tried to get a good. Yes, correct. And then people are also welcome to come to the park, use the shelter houses, and bring their own picnic. Really, it's just however you want to make it fun for you and your loved ones and experienced community.
The whole idea, obviously, is to get the community together, this big, huge celebration of our shared history and the celebration of our 250th birthday. And it's just a great excuse to get together and remind us all about kind of the sense of community.
Yes, absolutely. That was really the goal here, especially, and that's kind of why we chose to do it before the Civic Concert Band, to just highlight another great thing that we have in our community and just build upon, you know, what we already have.
And you mentioned the inflatables are free, so a lot of fun for the kids, and you know, no charge. It's a great opportunity. The concert obviously is free as well, so you know, just a great opportunity to get out in the park and enjoy the day. It looks like the weather is going to be absolutely fabulous. You mentioned the souvenirs got a lot of stuff kind of America 250 themed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the State Commission did send us our official picnic kit. And so it was a bunch of big boxes. Those were fun to open. But yeah, so there's kites that kids can decorate. There's some canvas bags for people to take away with. As I mentioned, some bandanas that you can decorate on your own. Everything to frisbees, you know, all kinds of fun stuff to just have a great evening in the park and take something away to kind of remember this momentous occasion by.
And again, it all begins at 5 o'clock, you said?
Correct. Yep. Meet us in the park at 5 o'clock tomorrow, Riverside Park.
And again, the Riverside Civic Concert Band, the Flag City Concert Band will be having their 75th anniversary show later on in the evening as well. So encourage folks to stick around for that, because that's going to be an awful lot of fun and a very special performance as well. Jacqueline Homan with the City of Findlay, and the big community picnic happening tomorrow at Riverside Park. Hey, Jacqueline, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program once again. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Find us online at goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would also appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. And we thank you very much. Coming up tomorrow on the program, The Declaration Decoded, helping the youngest Americans understand and appreciate our founding manifesto. Plus, what do the new federally mandated work requirements mean for Medicaid recipients in Ohio? So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.